between Labor Day and Election Day. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 93 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 85 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. And in a bit, we'll listen to an interview that was conducted with Ghada Francis, who basically has been an amazing, articulate, and very clear-headed analyst on what's happening in Lebanon in terms of in relationship to Gaza and in relationship to the ongoing genocide. But there's a few things I wanted to share with you. One is that we would be amiss if we don't acknowledge that the great James Baldwin would have been this week. He would have been, in fact, as of last weekend, he would have been 100 years old. So there's been some James Baldwin commemorations. And I wanted to talk about a little bit about James Baldwin in the context of the topics of our show, which relate to the Arab world and Palestine, and namely that James Baldwin was so far ahead of his time when it came to those issues, when it came to international politics, when it came to recognizing that this is basically you know, he was, for example, for one thing, he identified, he separated Zionism from Judaism, which is something that people are doing now, and in essence also going further, which is that Zionism is actually anti-Semitism, despite what these so-called institutes of higher education are claiming these days, are trying to muzzle their students and their faculty. The other thing that James Baldwin talked about, which you can sum it up, and it was actually summed up really well by Viet Thanh Nguyen, who is the Vietnamese American author, or The Sympathizer, which is on HBO now. I had the pleasure of seeing Viet at the National Book Fair, which happened recently at the convention center. And he talked about how Americans, you know, they, many Americans, and I'm not referring to, of course, the people on the street, the students that are setting up encampments, and actually, you know, and we'll talk a little bit about that, what's happening with the new year. I'm talking about these people that are just standing by, that as genocide happens, these people insist on their innocence as if like this is a completely separate thing from their lives, as if, you know, standing by and not participating, basically you can reclaim your innocence. So one theme that was talked about is like Americans' insistence on innocence when it comes to no, if you have not been involved, if you have not done anything, even something as simple as writing to your representative, which is really futile, but at least, you know, it's an attempt. If you've done nothing, then you are complicit. You are a good German, you know, there's if you've ever had the mystery, like you wondered what were all these Germans doing while Jews were being exterminated, Well, they're doing probably what you're doing right now, just sitting by and waiting for this thing to end instead of trying to end it. So that's one of James Baldwin's daring points that he had, and especially within debates with right-wingers. That's James Baldwin. The other thing that is that James Baldwin did travel to the Middle East, and specifically to Turkey, which we know it's not an Arab country, but he was exposed to the Middle East. In fact, some people who studied him had to go to Turkey to kind of follow his footsteps and what he did there. So and obviously he also lived in France, and he had the privilege of seeing different points of view besides what's happening in the United States. The other thing I wanted to talk about is that the students are returning to school now, and some of them, there's speculation whether there's going to be encampments, although many students have been suspended, some faculty have been laid off, and so on and so forth. But what I'm seeing now is actually, for example, the students that were involved in the GWU encampment, in the first week of their return, they gathered together and demonstrated in the street to make sure that the administrations know that they're not gonna give up just because these administrations are trying to muzzle them. We've discovered one of the biggest things that people are discovering is that these institutes of higher education, everything from Ivy League schools to down the line, they're complicit in genocide. They're complicit generally in the military industrial complex, and you could see the calls for divestment that have gone out by the students, by the faculty, by the demonstrators that have not really been answered except in a couple of schools. And what we're discovering is like these are schools that, even when right wingers and Nazis came on campus and wanted to speak, these schools defended their free speech. But God forbid you should talk about Palestine and liberation. God forbid you should talk about the barbarity of the Zionist regime. God forbid you should talk about the destruction of every college, every school in Gaza. God forbid you should talk about the 20,000 children that have been killed and dismembered. God forbid you should talk about the 180,000 Palestinians that have been killed. We are at our lowest moral standing in the United States, and the whole world sees this. And I'll keep repeating this at every show because this is a dying empire. And the problem is not whether it's dying or not. An empire can die, but a society can be sustained. But the problem with a dying empire, it's that flailing and as it goes down, and as it sends 20, recently it sent $20 billion to Israel. To further, to basically so that Israel can finish off Gaza, which is on, there's only a little strip of so-called safety, which we know that there's been no safety. So in the meantime, you actually have what's incredible. You actually have people that can't afford, many people that can't afford groceries. I know you're feeling it. When you go to the grocery store, it's preposterous. In the meantime, these companies that there, these handful of companies that control our food, transportation, and production has been, if you look at the quarterly returns, they're making so much money, which tells you that this inflation was a complete scam, to raise prices and increase their profit margin. The other thing is that I mentioned in an earlier show that we don't, of course, we don't have healthcare, but Israel, we subsidize the healthcare, and is the Israelis enjoy universal healthcare. They enjoy free education. We don't enjoy these things. We actually supplement it. And there's this vicious cycle of like donations that are happening, you know, where you have AIPAC, as we've seen with the Jamal Bowman and the Cori Bush campaigns. We see that vicious circle happening where, you know, money is donated to these candidates that so that they can beat any progressive person of color in Congress. And that money, by the way, it, you know, one thing we fail to see sometimes is that money comes back to the perpetrators, meaning in other forms. So we have AIPAC basically and you know, pumping money into this, but that money is returning to them or to the state of Israel in with actually you know multiples and multiples of profit. And the other thing is that the last thing I wanted to talk about is that there has been, as you could see, and this is the topic that's going to be discussed by Radi Francis is, with Rania Khalik. Now, we see one thing that's happening is that that it has happened in the past week. We've seen that finally, you know, when I was talking with people in Lebanon last week, and I said, "How are you doing?" And they said, "This is nail biting time," because they didn't know whether, you know, when the Lebanese resistance was going to retaliate, and what is going to be if you want to call, you know, the response, I should say, not retaliation, because this is a retaliation due to an attack on Lebanese sovereignty, on Lebanese land. And that attack basically happened, meaning the retaliatory attack by the Lebanese resistance has happened. And of course, the Israel, just to clarify, something I want listeners to understand is that Israel has been, we know the lies. They've all been played live on social media. We know the lies that they've been telling, you know, beheaded babies, mass rape. In the meantime, we actually have footage of them raping Palestinian prisoners. But one of the things that they lied about is that they took a preemptive strike on Lebanon, and that there were supposed to be thousands of rockets shot at Israel, launched at Israel, and that minimized it. The reality is that that's not the case. Of course, they're lying about it. And what this that kind of preemptive strike that Israel did actually was very limited, and it did damage to launching pads that are always abandoned after the pads are, you know, used. And we're talking about these launching pads that like cost like $8,000 to $10,000. So they, you know, they there was 100 warplanes launched, and they attacked Lebanon, but they can't hit anything substantive because everything is underground. And then at 5:15 in the one morning in the past week is when the Lebanese resistance actually did its operation, and they did what they initially had planned, not something that as Israel was claiming thousands of rockets. They had specific number, 340 rockets. They were launched. These are cheap Katyusha rockets. They were launched, and they were basically they weren't launched to hit targets. They were launched to scramble the defenses in Israel. And then that was followed by drones that actually went after the real target, which is the Mossad headquarters near Tel Aviv, and another spying kind of base that's used on spying, and also the targeting. It's a retaliatory action that answers the fact that Israel has a spying station that directs those remote assassinations through drones. So it was a direct answer to that. And the people who were speculating that the Lebanese resistance is going to hit civilians, they specifically, the Lebanese resistance and Hamas are much more honorable, and much more humanitarian than anything that the Zionists can put out, because they do not, they have they're the ones that are deliberately avoiding civilian casualties. They're confronting the Israeli military in time, and all the Israeli military can do is just continue the project that they started way before October 7th, which is the genociding. They went from a slow genocide to a sped up ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So that's what really happened. And there's all sorts of lies being told about what was targeted, like a chicken. The Israeli media saying it was chicken farms and such. And of course, the U.S. media, including NPR, followed suit. They're the most unprincipled liars, whether it's NPR or whether it's Washington Post or New York Times. They've been proven to be shameless as all these institutes of higher education, as all these administrations of all these colleges, all over the United States. So th with that, let's move on to the interview between Rania Khalik and Ghadi Francis about that Israel's cowardice. And this is really clarifies the kind of multi-ethnic, multi-religious kind of solidarity that happens in Lebanon, as opposed to what the Orientalist image that is given to us through US media. So let's have a listen to this fabulous interview with the brilliant Ghadi Francis.
The Israelis are cowards. The biggest threat to Jews and Judaism is Israel itself. They just bring them from all around the world to sit here and colonize land, and they make them human shields. I'm more free in a third world country that lives through civil war. I am more free to say my say as a journalist than any American journalist. I mean, I don't think the Americans are doing okay, So this whole myth that they sell to us in the third world countries or Lebanon or in the Arab region or the Middle East, oh, the American dream. No, I don't want that dream.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Khalik, and this is Dispatches. Israel's genocide in Gaza has gone on for 9 months, seemingly with no end in sight. There appear to be no red lines for what Israel can do. Its army can wipe out entire neighborhoods, displace 2 million people over and over again, drop 2,000-pound U.S.-supplied bombs on tents full of refugees who've been deliberately starved of food, water, and medicine, destroy every hospital in Gaza, and kidnap and torture the doctors, nurses, and patients. And the Israelis continue lying that their Palestinian victims are the ones committing the atrocities, even as Israeli soldiers and leaders openly celebrate their genocidal intent. All the while, Israel keeps threatening Lebanon with annihilation as its propaganda army lays the groundwork with easily disproven lies about Hezbollah. Be sure to hit the subscribe button and the bell so you get a notification whenever we post new content. Ghadi Francis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again, Rania.
It's such a pleasure to have you on again. There's so much I want to talk to you about. And I had you on a few months back. And what's crazy is I went back to find the episode to see when it was I had you on, because it doesn't feel like it was that long ago. But it was in December, actually, in the beginning of December. We did an episode. And in the beginning of December, I mean, we were talking a lot about it's crazy. Yeah. So like December was what, 3-4 months in. Now we're at 9 months, going on 10 months. The death toll, you know, they stopped counting because they can't really count anymore. But you have the Lancet saying it might be as high as or higher than 186,000 people in Gaza killed. There was an article in the New York Times recently that I'm sure you saw as well. That's, you know, showed that the Israelis, as they're holding these Palestinians, they basically kidnapped from Gaza in these concentration camps that they're calling prisons. They've been sodomizing them to death with metal sticks. I mean, it's just what we're hearing is so disgusting. And, you know, one thing I've noticed about me, and I don't know if you can relate to this, is I have stopped having a visceral reaction to images that come across my social media feed. It's like I feel numb now to watching people being blown up. And I fear I'm becoming like desensitized to basically like our people in this region just being mass murdered. So I all that's to set you up. I just like your perspective on, now that we're nine, almost 10 months into this horrific genocide, what are your general thoughts on the fact that it's still ongoing? There doesn't seem to be an end in sight. And we're just watching babies be torn to shreds.
I think there's no way to tell people how to handle it, especially people like us who have a conscience and cannot think of anything else other than the genocide. Because there are people around the world who are not like us, Rania. There are people around the world who don't care and who are more interested in finding out who hit Donald Trump's ear in the same day that babies in tents were hit by bombs from F-16s from the so-called American democracy. So it's all proportional now to what kind of human you have chosen to be and how involved you are. And there's no way in telling people how they should handle seeing massacres. I want to tell you, I thought I was numb until this morning. I was watching an old new video of a mom trying to look for her son's grave, because they actually, she had buried him, and they actually, in their most recent massacre, the Israelis also tore the graveyard as well and bombed it. And then in the end, she found the grave after digging sand with her bare hands. And that broke me this morning. And I had thought I'm numb too. I don't think we're numb. I think we're just trying to adjust to the reality that our duty today is to keep our voices and to keep screaming and to try to sustain as much as we can our mental health, to be the delivery, to try to be the delivery for our people who have no voices, who the world don't want to listen to or to hear or to see. I'm talking about you personally, Rania, as a journalist, in your work, in your field, as an American Lebanese journalist. I'm talking about myself personally, as a journalist, as an activist, as a human who has a platform to talk to other humans about this, or to like shake some conscience out there. Our job is not to be numb, but our job is to be as realistic as possible and to understand that this struggle is a 76-year-old struggle. And even more, if you go back in the history of the Levant and of our nation, I'm speaking about Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, Mesopotamia. This land, this whole land is holy because it's a very rich culture. It's a melting pot of civilization, of tradition, of strength, of resources. And even the humans of this land have always been pioneers. So this land has been under these kinds of raids from barbaric colonizers throughout history. We have suffered a lot, and our ancestral pain always is inside us. And I think this is why we are more resilient and resistant and strong. And this is why the people of Gaza are surprising the world. Because even as all these atrocities that we are seeing and hearing about are happening, they are still finding strength to go to the beach, to sing a song, to make a vlog about food that they are making from the scarce grains or sugar that they are getting. They are still finding it in themselves to teach everyone else that life, they don't only deserve life, they are masters of life, they are masters of resistance. So I think our job today is to know that this struggle is very bloody, and the price is very high. And these atrocities that we are seeing are only going to pave the way to the liberty. There is no coming back from here. There is no way coming back from here. The world will not surpass that. Humankind cannot step over that. When the Lancet, one of the oldest medical journals in Britain, talks about 186,000 deaths, and this can be more because the massacre, they spoke, if it stopped today, that would be the number, and it didn't stop. So when you have these pieces of truths spread all around the world, whether it's from South Africa and the ICC, from the Lancet Journal, from all these human rights activists and people around the world screaming in the streets after 9 months, you see that it is, there's no coming back from here. No matter what happens, there is only one way forward, and it is the liberty and the justice for the Palestinian people.
That's so incredibly said, and I want to ask you to elaborate on a couple of things you touched on, because I think it's really important, since we're speaking to a mostly English-speaking audience, likely most people who are watching are based in the U.S., and people are learning a lot for the first time about this region. So you said something really important. You talked about our region, and you mentioned many countries. You didn't mention just Lebanon. You didn't mention just Palestine. You mentioned Syria. You mentioned Iraq, and on. And so I want to talk a little bit about divide and conquer, because that's been the strategy by imperialists in this region, is to divide and conquer, to split us up by country, by sect. And something that you're quite known for in Lebanon is you give very fiery interviews, very, you know, if people think you speak well in English, I mean, your Arabic is, you know, unmatched. You talk a lot from a perspective of, you talk about yourself as Palestinian, as Syrian, as Lebanese, as all of these things. And I think that kind of is confusing for people, because when people in the U.S. hear about this issue, they think of Palestine as this one space, this one country, Lebanon separate, Syria separate, Iraq is separate, and it's all one big Muslim issue if you're going to connect it in any way. Neither you or I are Muslim, and we care very deeply about this issue because this is our land too. So I just kind of want you to explain that to people who maybe don't know that or understand it that way, don't understand the history of how this region has been split by the Americans, by the French, by the British, with borders as well as by sect, and why when you talk about Palestine, you talk about it like it's your land too.
Well, you know, in this world, everybody has a freedom to identify personally, no matter, like, they choose to be non-binary sometimes, they choose to be leftist, rightist, they choose to be neo-Nazis in Europe sometimes, and they give them the freedom to be that. I chose that history didn't stop after the World War I, after they divided this region. I just chose that whatever the Western powers did after the World War I and after they conquered the Ottoman Empire to this region is not definitive and it's not defining. We had one colonization, the Ottomans, and then the Ottomans lost the war. And then the French and the British and the Americans and all the people who conquered the Ottomans were dividing influence and land and money and power in this region. And they drew borders that are very funny. If we were two separate nations between Lebanon and Syria, you can walk there and it's the same families. There's no actual distance. Some homes are like partitioned between the two newly formed states. This is the same for Palestine and the same between Iraq and Syria, because these borders were man-made and politics made. Now, I'm not speaking as if I want no Iraq, no Syria, no Palestine, no Lebanon today. I'm a very realistic person. I'm not saying that today we can all be one nation and call ourselves Greater Syria like it was. It actually was just before the World War I ended. And this is not, it's not a point of view, it's just a point of history. Anybody, any person, any human can just go to the simplest search platform, Google, and they can Google what was here 100 years ago. What was Beirut? What was Tripoli? What was Safad? What was this land called? And how was it governing itself? And what kind of culture did it have? And what kind of transportation systems? And even touristic campaigns? How did people come here? How did they visit? How did the travel books that came out in the 18th and the 19th century? There are tens and hundreds of travel books written by actual Western people who visited this area. And if they don't like to listen to a like brown Lebanese girl tell them facts, they can listen to white people, white colonizers in the 18th century. They said the same about this region. So I identify as a human from the melting pot of civilization, from the greater Syria. Our traditions and our culture is blended. We are part of Babylon. We are part of the best civilizations out there in the history. I am so proud that thousands of years ago in our land and in our nation, people invented communication skills, arts, even law and regulations and humanitarian issues where there females were empowered. The history of my land gives me so much pride, just like any human would be proud of where they come from or who their ancestry is. The problem is some people are just victims of the brainwash that has happened constantly for decades. We cannot really blame people in Lebanon if they identify as the religion or the sect, because they're coming from civil war. And at some time in the 70s, their sect or their religious identity was their whole existential being, which was persecuted. So it is only natural for many people in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, after decades of war and colonization and problems and poverty, and very funded, very widely funded media worked on us. And I'm not talking about today's mainstream media, Rania. Imagine, in the 30s, the Zionists funded a newspaper in Lebanon to make Christians Christians and not Lebanese. I'm talking about 1930, and this is written in Eliyahu Sasson's papers. It is written by the Zionists themselves. They used to fund media and play on the general awareness, because this is the way to conquer. And I don't think it's all bad. I think it's good to recite and say what happened here to be able to find our way out. Today, if just let's think about it. If Damascus, Baghdad, Beirut, Jerusalem, Amman, if these cities had a shared transportation system, tourism, economy, and if they could use their oil and their resources, do you think any other regional power can play with them? I'm talking about the Gulf or Iran or Turkey. A greater Syrian nation, a Levantine nation, would be pioneering worldwide, because it's very rich, and they're the human there, our humans are very knowledgeable and educated, and they spread their knowledge all around the world. You can see them. If these people that came from this land and went all across the world and did all kinds of success, and if this land was governed by its own people and they were connected to each other, there is no power that could take and that can choose which part of our land to take and to give to Manhattan people or to Polish people, like it's happening in Palestine. So it was the first way to take our land was to change our identities into very manageable and easily manipulated identity. And the easiest way to control someone is to tell them it's like God told me that you should be this way, and to make them really follow you and to involve God in it, like a bigger, higher conscious power. So it worked for a long time, but I refuse to think that it will be the end of Lebanon or Syria or Jordan, because I can see like more than 30% of people in every time in Lebanon, there's something that shakes the political status quo. For example, the beginning of the uprisings, not after they are politicized, the beginnings of the uprisings, or sometimes in the elections, some candidates and how the numbers and how these fights, like these normal democratic fights happen in the communities, they tell me, no, I'm not the only Christian that was born in a house that prays to God in the Christian way, but thinks that this is all about religion and politics has nothing to do with it. I think there's a very big amount of people, whether they're Christian, Muslim, atheists, regardless how they choose to lead with their spiritual life, we share one common ground in politics. We want a secular system. We want a wider nation. We want sovereignty. We want to have our own say in how to use our own land. And this is why I refuse to say like whatever the patriarch says or the mufti says. I don't want to even listen to them. They're irrelevant to me.
Oh, that's a fair point. It's a fair point. And I mean, that's not to deny, obviously, you know, because then the people who are against what you're saying would say, oh, but then look at the people who are fighting. They're all Islamists. And they'll point to that. But I also think it's important to recognize that, I mean,
they're not all Islamists.
They're not all Islamists.
No, no. We want to tell them that if they have a problem with the actual Islamism of the resistance, this is only a result of their introduction to these people for 100 years telling us that we are sects. Mm-hmm. You know, when people are more religious, it's a result of this is the consequences that happen, you know. But we want to remind the world that the first act of resistance happened in this land when the first mother refused to leave her home. And that has happened since day one in Palestine and in Lebanon. And people were not Islamist then. They were just indigenous people. And today, we refuse to see them as anything else. They are the indigenous people, regardless of how they pray, what they choose in politics. They are fighting for their homes. There are many Islamists around the world. I don't see that they have any problem with ISIS in Eastern Syria. They like Islamists over there, the West. They buy petrol and oil from them. They don't mind them over there. They don't mind Islamists if they are serving their purposes. And by the way, if you go back a little bit more in history to the 70s and to the 60s, if you want to ask who introduced the idea of al-Mujahideen to fight whom in the region, well, it's the Americans. They wanted to fight the Soviets, you know? So don't speak to us about Islam as if you are very innocent, because your hands are all over that. You know, your fingerprints in politics and in policies in the Middle East. I'm speaking to the West now. Their fingerprints are all over that. I just want to always insist and remind people who are following us today, who are viewing what we are saying, that there are communists not only died fighting the Israelis in Lebanon, there are communist young girls like Lola Abboud. She went and she bombed herself to kill Israelis. She was communist. She wasn't Islamist. She didn't have a heaven to go to. There wasn't any book that told her to do that. She was simply angry because they slaughtered her people. And she simply wanted to die fighting them just because it was that unjust and that cruel. And there's a similar girl from South Lebanon. She wasn't an Islamist. Her name is Sana Mahaidli. She was 18 years old. She drove a car filled with bombs and killed herself and 14 Israelis at a checkpoint when the Israelis occupied Lebanon. She wasn't Islamist. She was a Syrian social nationalist. She didn't care about the afterlife. And she said in her message, I hope after I die, my spirit and the spirit of other martyrs, my friends like me, would form a new bomb and we would bomb ourselves again to conquer the occupation. So these people and these ideologies were not Islamic. It wasn't up until the Islamic Republic in Iran started and the Islamic Revolution in Iran won that the Islamic resistance became a part of Lebanon. In Lebanon, and it was in the 1979. But let's not forget what happened in the 60s and in the 80s, and let's not forget what is happening today. And it's the resistance. I refuse to designate resistance as only fighting with weapons. I say every single mother who is going back and cleaning her house and the rubble is a top fighter in our resistance. Every single little girl who's recording a vlog and singing is a leader in the resistance. The resistance is the act of existing when everybody in the world is paying billions of dollars to make you a refugee and to make you leave your country. So everybody in Palestine is resisting. Everybody in Lebanon is resisting. Even the people that, as we record this interview, they are sitting at the beach enjoying the beautiful seaside of Lebanon, or maybe a cup of beer. They are resisting as well because they refuse to leave their country. And now we are fighting billions of dollars whose all they want to do is take our land and make us and turn us into refugees. That is if we survive.
I think that's so important to say. And you know who recognizes exactly what you're saying is the Israelis. I mean, that's why they attack journalists, they attack intellectuals, they attack Palestinians no matter what they're doing, whether they have weapons or whether they don't, because existing is a form of resistance, writing, doing vlogs from Gaza. And like you said, literally just not leaving your land is a form of resistance when you're constantly at risk of being ethnically cleansed. And like you said, with a billions of dollars project. And to speak to the issue of Lebanon, I just want to show you, in case you didn't see it, Israel's new propaganda as they try to prepare some sort of propagandistic groundwork for what they think they can do to Lebanon. So I'm going to play two things, actually. First, I'm going to play...
they're going to do to Lebanon?
Well, first, yeah. I'm going to play the Israeli education minister speaking last week. Okay. So let's go ahead and listen to him. For those who are just listening, I'm sorry, it's Hebrew, and there's I'll give you a summary after it's over. So here we go.
אז אני אומר את זה לצרפתים, לצרפתים ולאחרים, מה שנקרא, ממדינות העולם שטוענות את זה. אין שום הבדל בין חיזבאללה ללבנון. לבנון תושמד לאור כמו שהדברים מתקדמים. ואני אומר את זה אפילו עכשיו בצורה מאוד בוטה. אנחנו באירוע שבו לבנון הולכת לקראת השמדה. לא תהיה אותה לבנון כמו שהם מכירים. אני לא הולך להתעסק בצייד קטיושות של חיזבאללה. את המחיר התוקפנות מאדמת לבנון תשלם מדינת לבנון.
ראש, השתמשתי במילה, אני לא אמרת, ביקשת שאני לא אקטע אותך. תושמד. השמדה יש לה במינוח העברי, אתה יודע, לשר הביטחון אמר, תחזור לימי האבן.
אתה יודע מה, אני מתקן את דבריי, לא תושמד. לבנון, כמו שאנחנו מכירים אותה, לא תהיה קיימת. לבנון תשלם את המחיר הכבד בגלל חיזבאללה. ואני מתקן את דבריי, לא תושמד. אז אני אומר את זה ל...
Okay, so for those who were just listening and couldn't see the subtitles, that's Israel's education minister. This man is in charge of their education system, saying that he wants to annihilate Lebanon. And then he corrects himself because he's challenged by the TV host, who seems a bit shocked. He corrects himself and says, no, forget annihilation. Lebanon will cease to exist. So I'm just curious, you know, what's your response to that attitude by the Israelis? Please, Rebbe, go ahead.
I want to see footage of him while our Hudhud drone flies over, running. Under the sounds of sirens, running to the shelter. I want to see that kind of footage, because I'm sure he's doing a lot of that these days. Mm. Well, if they, Rania, it's very nice that the whole world can see who they are and what they want. It's very nice that they are actually telling the world who they are, but some racist people around the world refuse to see them as who they are, even when they say that. And they want us to be designated as terrorists when we hold a flag, a Palestinian flag. It's that biased in the world. But I want to tell everyone, including these people that think that, you know, I want to tell them all that the Israelis have always wanted to do that. It's not a matter of what they want to do or what they would wish to do. It's a matter of what they can do. And I would really like to state a factual fact. Not my feeling or pride, because I'm so proud to be a Lebanese, especially in these days. I am so proud to be a Lebanese and to be that important in my solidarity with my brothers and sisters in Palestine, because these baby killers have only one fear in the Middle East, and it is the Lebanese people. And I'm so proud. I'm so proud. They don't fear the ICC. They don't fear, and they fear our, he called them Katyusha. I can advise people to do some Google about what kind of artillery and what kind of military AI technology Hezbollah is using. And if it's only Katyusha that really defeated the Iron Dome, I mean, man, you have to reconsider your Iron Dome. If it's only Katyusha that Hezbollah has, how come the Iron Dome was defeated? And what about the Golan Heights? Do you still have any tower over there? I mean, if it's only Katyusha, then there's no such thing as Israeli excellence in military. Well, there isn't. But I'm just trying to like entertain the idea that this sick person was saying. And and after that, not only they couldn't. Another fact, like in 2006, and on a day like today, there was war. In July, between July and August, there was war for 33 days, constant planes, ships, on the ground, tanks. They tried everything. They bombed even northern Lebanon. They bombed infrastructure. They bombed everything. They couldn't take 1 meter of land. 1 meter. They couldn't take 1 meter of Lebanon's land. Not one squared meter. So we're talking today more than 15 years later of a lot of expertise have grown and a lot of new technologies have been encrypted in the systems of the resistance. So some part of me knows that there will come a point where they're gonna try to invade Lebanon, and I can't wait to show them lesson number two.
You think
they can take nothing.
Of
course it's inevitable, because we are dealing with barbaric people who just want to kill us all, who just protest against getting milk to babies. They are openly calling for slaughter one way or the other. And even if it stops for a period of time, there will be another season of this war, because in this place of the world, it's either the indigenous people or the invaders. There's no way to go into peace after 186,000 people are slaughtered. I mean, people who call for peace, I would really like to see their stance if this happens in their countries. If someone comes from Poland and takes your home and kills 200,000 people in 7 months in your country, you'd like to coexist with them. Well, peace be upon you, but we don't.
I know. I mean, I think that's really fair. And I think most people would absolutely fight for their survival. It's just a matter of, you know, not seeing people in this region as being human enough to be allowed to fight for their survival. But Ghadi, I think there's something else important that's happening now. And, you know, we talked about this the last time I had you on. You have traveled across the region. You've reported from every war zone, from Yemen, from Iraq, from Syria, from Lebanon. You've been to Gaza. You've been to Gaza's tunnels. And so, you know, when you think about wars of the past and what we're seeing take place now, as horrible as it is, you do see this new, I don't know if I want to call it a level of coordination, but there's resistance groups in every country and they're all participating in some way. It's kind of, it's really historic to watch. And if Israel was to unleash some sort of bigger war in Lebanon than it already has, we know that Hezbollah wouldn't be alone. Just as in many ways, Hamas, you know, is fighting the fight. They're at the forefront of it in Gaza, but there's other participants around the region as well. So I'm just curious if, you know, your views, your perspective on having watched the region change and shift and just kind of seeing this axis of resistance, not just form, but really come together and working to, you know, almost in conjunction with each other, to the point where you have the Yemenis firing at the Israelis and stopping ships, and the Iraqis firing when they can. And of course, Hezbollah's firing every single day, and Hamas, and then in the West Bank, there's groups as well. I mean, we've never seen anything like this.
I think this extends to the people in the campuses in the United States of America, and to the journalists and to the doctors that are being persecuted all across the world for their views and for their solidarity. The front is big. It depends on the amount of humanity that you have in you. And I think these people, regardless of the tag that they are in access, they are humans. They are just being humans. And what use is all the arms and the weapons if at such times they don't show their solidarity? I mean, if every human in the region, if every so-called Islam person really wanted to stand next to their brothers of Islam in Palestine, I'm talking about Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, actually, other than the political side, if everybody wanted to arm Palestinians, that would be the end of it. But nobody wants to say no to America. And I wanted to just put one note, Rania, when we say if the Israelis wanted an open war. with Hezbollah. They don't know anything about war. They can't win any war. It's an American war. We have seen that the Israelis are like they bring mercenaries, cowards. They dance very well on TikTok. Other than that, we've seen them. Some of them are speaking in their Congress or whatever. You can see their clips about their about the tremendous mental health issues that they have, because they know they're fighting for no cause or no reason. They have been brought here to kill innocent people who have been born here to like a long line of families. So in the end, the Israelis cannot do anything. It's a matter of the American decision, I suppose, because they can stop giving them weapons. That would be done. They can stop giving them immunity in the UN and impunity. That will be done. They can stop funding all the organizations that are working to dehumanize Palestinians in media, and that will be done. They are the active part of the war. The Israelis are only the pawns, the very racist, barbaric, anti-human, child killer pawns.
I want to also ask you about when you talk about these different fronts, and you mentioned the campuses, and you know, you do spend quite a bit of time going back and forth between Lebanon and various Western countries, particularly across Europe. And you've gone to protests, for example. I know you've been to protests in London, and you've always been very, very supportive of campus protests across the U.S. So, you know, just from your vantage point, This is the first time I've seen this much widespread support for Palestine across Western countries. So I'm curious what that looks like for you. I mean, you've grown up in Lebanon. You've spent your time, most of your life, across the Middle East. So watching the movements and the activism across the West, do you think it matters?
I think it matters so much. And I'm so happy to feel seen when I see these young people. When I see these young Londoners angry for my people, I swear to God, it's really relieving in too many ways. I can't even start describing. It makes me feel seen as a race, as a human, as a country, as a person, as a Palestinian, as a Lebanese. It makes me feel like all the screaming that we have done and all the work that we have done, it has not gone in vain. People see us, see our cause, you know? And moreover, I haven't seen this kind of solidarity in Lebanon. It just felt only natural that I'm here to go and see what's happening in the street. Because in Lebanon, we didn't get that. Because I wish if the general youth awareness about Palestine in Lebanon came close to what we witnessed in the American colleges and in the British colleges. I wish we had that in Lebanon. We are too busy fighting each other and too busy conquering each other's ideologies that are more than thousands years old, religious or whatever. And a lot of money has been put to polarize our youth into that, like Shi'i, Sunni, Uwait, Kata'ib, Hezbollah, Harakat Amal, the fights on social media. And when they actually went to protest for Palestine in the beginning of the massacre, it turned really turbulent and wasn't really beautiful. It wasn't really done well. Some of the political parties, of the traditional political parties, tried to show solidarity, but it wasn't enough. I knew at some point I went to a Safir newspaper, and there was like a Najah Wakim, a very veteran political figure in Lebanon, was calling for a conference for Palestine, and there was this full press release about it. And I remember I was angry over there at everyone. I'm telling them, why do you want to make press releases? Go and disrupt some, like, protest in front of the AUBMC because doctors are being killed. Do something to show something. Stop writing press releases. I mean, we have been, and this is a point really touched very well by Antoun Saadi, the thinker that I revere and I believe is my teacher. So Antoun Saadi back then says that one of the main problems about the Palestinian issue is that we made it an Arab issue. So it became just kind of a protocol or a routine, or we do that, we say that, we sing that, we recite that poem, and we go back home. We didn't actually feel it. It became something too wide and general. So everybody has a part in this general cause at 76 decades. So we have been normalized into, okay, we die, we protest, we go back home. While the young people, the young generation that has shown its voice to the world, they refuse to make it a tradition or something normal. It's not normal. It's not Arab. It's personal. It's human. It's me. It's my sister. It's a journalist like me. So I think the trend of making Palestine an Arab issue fades. Palestine is a Palestinian issue. It's a Lebanese issue. It's a Syrian issue. It's an issue of the people that are directly targeted by these colonizers in the history of this war, and making it an Arab or an Islamic issue did not really help it in the past. We haven't seen that kind of solidarity from any entity that calls itself like a big big wave of Arabism or Islamism. Didn't serve Palestine well. The people.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, August 28th. Here are some headlines. The U.S. Department of Justice filed a revised indictment against Donald Trump yesterday over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The revised indictment brought by DOJ Special Counsel Jack Smith does not substantially change the criminal case against him, but rather aims to protect it after a Supreme Court ruling in July said that Trump and other presidents have immunity for official acts while in office. The document retains the same four criminal charges, but portions are rewritten to emphasize that Trump was not acting in an official capacity when he tried to overturn the election, but that Trump was acting as a candidate seeking political office. If the case goes to trial, that won't happen until after the election, and if Trump wins the election in November, he could ask the Justice Department to dismiss the case. In related news, the man prosecutors say was the first rioter to enter the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, was sentenced yesterday to more than 4 years in prison. A federal jury in March found Kentucky resident Michael Sparks guilty of several counts, including felony obstruction of an official proceeding and civil disorder. During his sentencing hearing, Michael Sparks told the judge he still believes in false theories that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. More than 1,400 people have been charged in connection with the attack on the Capitol, and prosecutors have secured more than 1,000 convictions. Donald Trump has repeatedly said he would consider pardoning his supporters for their actions on January 6 if he is elected in November. In other news, the Israeli military launched a large offensive in the occupied West Bank last night, killing at least 10 militants, according to Hamas, and sealing off the city of Jenin. Israeli forces have stepped up operations in the West Bank since the war in Gaza began last October, but last night's offensive was one of the largest in months. An Israeli military spokesperson said the offensive was the first stage in an even larger operation. The governor of Jenin said on Palestinian radio that Israeli troops had blocked access to hospitals and damaged infrastructure in the city. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz said operations in the West Bank should include the temporary evacuation of Palestinian residents. In more international news, Mexican President López Obrador told reporters today that he put relations with the U.S. and Canadian embassies on pause, but didn't provide details on what that meant. The ordered pause comes after the U.S. and Canada both critiqued a proposed judicial overhaul in Mexico that would, in part, require judges to stand for election. That overhaul has faced sustained protests from federal court workers and judges. Critics of the overhaul say it threatens judicial independence and expertise and could harm merit-based pay and promotions for court workers. U.S. Ambassador Ken Salazar last week said the proposal could harm trade between the U.S. and Mexico. López Obrador and his ally, President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum's ally, President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum, have defended the proposed overhaul. And in weather today in New York City, it is...